Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today to talk about the issues that empower us. And this indeed is the Empowerment Hour. Today, the latest on health and healing, vitamin E. It can impact cancer. Also, many individuals change their moral position without even realizing it. What does that mean? Statins, millions of Americans are taking statins to prevent blood clots. Trouble is, a large analysis study shows they don't prevent blood clots. Also, the anti-inflammatory power of red onions. I knew they were good for something. So we'll get into all this. Plus, today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Peter Bregan. And we're going to talk about what happens if you're trying to get off psychiatric meds. Withdrawal is a serious issue. There are dangers involved. And also, why are we accepting as legitimate all of these psychiatric diagnoses? We'll ask him, because he's a leading psychiatrist. He's called the conscience of psychiatry during an outstanding career. He was at the National Institute of Mental Health. He is a Harvard graduate. So we'll get into that with him. Then our commentary today is one that I want to share with you and have you call in and respond. The tyranny of the American Liberalism Redux by Professor James F. Tracy from Global Research. Very provocative what he says. I've never heard anyone else discuss it this way. I'll share it with you, and then I'd like your input. So we have a lot to go with. Let us begin. First off, vitamin E is best taken in its natural form, and it's best taken when it's mixed, meaning you're getting four really primary fractions, the alpha, the beta, the delta, and the gamma. Also, when you're getting the subfractions called tocotrienols. Now, for those people who are getting ozone, and some people are quite simply, in my opinion, are getting way too much ozone, and I'm very concerned. Let me just, for a second, tell you the protocol. Because you get too much ozone, you're going to have sclerosing of the veins. And then when you may need a vitamin C drip or need something intravenous, you're going to have a hard time finding a vein. There's some really good science supporting some treatments with ozone. I have a major documentary on it. But I also, in interviewing the people, with one exception, they are very judicious. They do not overdo it. I believe if you have hepatitis, herpes, cytomegalovirus, chronic fatigue syndrome, many of the reasons people are getting it, have blood chemistry done on a regular basis to see where you're at in your recovery process. Otherwise, as what would happen when I was walking up the street last week, and a person stopped me and said, "Oh, I just want to thank you. You know, I listened to your show and I heard you talking well about ozone, and I'm getting it." I said, "Good." I said, "Are you seeing a difference?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, how long have you been getting?" He said, "A year and a half." I said, "And how frequently?" He said, "Oh, 3 days a week." I said, "And what does your blood chemistry show?" He says, "I've never had a blood chemistry." I said, "Well, why would you continue to come back 3 days a week for a year and a half without knowing whether or not you were benefiting or not?" "Well, because, you know, the doctor said." I said, "The doctor should be challenged. I would go to a different doctor. I wouldn't see any doctor that doesn't demand at least quarterly blood results. It's an inexpensive, easy test to do. That way, if your liver enzymes come down, if your viral load comes down, then good. It's showing you're benefiting. But what if it doesn't? Then all you're doing is spending an awful lot of money for a very inexpensive therapy, but you're also sclerosing your veins." So it kind of surprised the person, but that's the rule on this. Always have a blood profile prior to starting any therapy so you know what your baseline is. Then, unless it's a very severe situation, generally it's only twice a week, and then after 3 months have another blood profile done. And if you're not getting results that are measurable, then don't get any more, because it's you're needing a different therapy altogether. Maybe homeopathic or naturopathic or energy rebalancing. But I'm just saying, I'm seeing patterns of this, and it's unfortunate, because I think some people are just in it for the money, and I wish it was otherwise, but that's the world we live in. So heads up on that. In any case, one of the things that vitamin E does, it helps your veins. It increases the integrity of your veins. I know when I was getting my intravenous vitamin drips, massive amount, I was using myself as an experimental guinea pig for a year, 6 days a week, 200,000 milligrams of vitamin C and other nutrients, and I was getting my blood chemistry done every 2 weeks. I had 25 major blood chemistries because I wanted to see exactly what was happening. And if I could see by my blood chemistry that I was really benefiting and I had nothing wrong with me, but I then decided to challenge my immune system by going out and racing. I did six marathons in 7 weeks. I did a 50K, which is a 31-mile race. I did 81 races in a 52-week period. Now that, and training 100 miles a week, that's really stressing your immune system. I wanted to see, would this help it, not hurt it? And it turned out it helped it. I was able to maintain a healthy immune system through all that, where a couple people who were doing it with me, the training and the racing, their immune systems collapsed about a quarter of the way through. So vitamin E is just crucial to all this. And also it was what I used in order to keep my veins healthy. Otherwise, you can have some problems. Now, here's the latest reason to take your vitamin E. This is from the Lerner Research Institute and published in Clinical Cancer Research. It says the following. Vitamin E may decrease cancer risk in people with genetic disorders, which means that there are some people who have a genetic predisposition, but that doesn't mean that you're automatically going to get a condition because you have susceptibility to some form of gene mutation. So by taking vitamin E, it was able to prevent that mutation from manifesting. But most people don't know if they have a gene mutation, so why not just do the right thing? Take vitamin E every day. I suggest mixed tocopherols anywhere from 400 to 800 units. Now, another nutrient I believe we should be taking on a regular basis is curcumin. In this particular study, published in Phytotherapy Research, the peer-reviewed journal, and done at Mashhad University of Medical Sciences in Iran and University of Kiel in England, they found that it lowered lipid activity, meaning blood fats, triglycerides also. And if you have elevated triglycerides, that's not good. You're more susceptible to heart attack. And they did this in a placebo-controlled, randomized, and double-blind clinical trial. So they were able to observe that the cholesterol remained the same, but the dangerous triglycerides were kept low. Good results. One more reason to take your curcumin, anywhere from 400 to 4,000 milligrams a day. Now, purple corn is excellent for kidney health, especially diabetic kidney health. Now, a lot of diabetics end up going on dialysis. A lot of diabetics have kidney failure. And according to the peer-reviewed journal, the American Journal of Physiology, Renal Physiology, scientists at Hallam University in Korea found that purple corn protects against the development of kidney condition, diabetic neuropathy, which is a very serious condition. So that's good. Also, yogurt lowered blood pressure and reduced the incidence of hypertension. This was a study sponsored by the American Heart Association's High Blood Pressure Research Scientific Sessions Group. And what they found was adding more yogurt to your diet without increasing the number of calories you eat, meaning not the sugary one, lowered your blood pressure. All right, here's what I would do. I would say you don't have to have the yogurt. You can have the rice yogurt, the coconut yogurt, the soy yogurt, the almond milk yogurt, because it's not the yogurt that's making a difference. It is the probiotics. and you can get good, healthy bacteria in all of those other yogurt alternatives, dairy alternatives. People change moral positions without even realizing. This was from the Public Library of Science, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal PLOS One. I'll quote this. I found it interesting. Shortly after expressing a moral view about a difficult topic, people may easily endorse the opposite view and remain blind to the psychological mismatch. Now, let me explain this from a very pragmatic point of view. Let's say that we say we are for democracy and freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of our right to choose our elected officials. And we believe that. We believe that there should be ethics and decency. And then we turn around and we eat a hamburger or french fries or barbecued ribs, knowing full well they're not good for us. We may like them, but we know they're not good for us. People are not stupid. We'll smoke. Though, if you ask someone who smokes, they'll say, I want to live a good, healthy life. Then they smoke. Or take that to a national level. We want to give people jobs. So we're going to give all the money to the people who are not going to create a single job, the banks, because they're going to use this money for investing in hedge funds and derivatives and exotic investment strategies. But they're not going to give small businesses any money because they don't get enough return. But they said they wanted to create jobs. So everywhere you look, we say we want peace, and yet you go into a country that we were there to bring peace, and you see that we have provided the environment for ethnic cleansing, mass destruction of their environment and their infrastructure, their water supplies, electric supplies. We have caused massive, in Iraq and Afghanistan, massive dislocation, starvation, human suffering that people haven't seen since the end of the Second World War in Germany. And we create this. So which is it? Do we want to bring the world peace, or do we want to bring an imperial overreach, in which case we will not look at the results of our effort towards peace? We want to educate our children. Every school teacher does. Every school administrator does. Everyone in the system does. And yet we're educating, more often than not, illiterates or people who may have an education, but it's overly specific and highly stressed and does not allow them a chance to really understand the principles of what education is, to question, to challenge, to look deeper into an issue, to see its meaning, its nuance, its purpose. So how is it with all of our effort, all of our money and resources to create more educated children, we're creating more illiterates and social misanthropes than ever before in our history? So this is this idea that we will change a moral position without realizing it. So if you ask someone, do you want to be healthy? Sure, I want to be healthy. Okay, then why are you morbidly obese? And then you start hearing all the defense mechanisms click in. If you want to create jobs, it's simple. It's easy. You want to de-ghettoize America? Where over half the counties in the United States right now are considered disaster areas, then go in there and create a new farming program. Get people back to the land. Give them an opportunity to farm organically. Give young people a chance to go out and plant trees. The more trees we plant, the less global warming we have. Stop eating animal proteins. Well, that would reduce global warming. I'd also make people healthier, less reliant upon hospitals. Why don't we promote health clinics in every community in the United States based upon true principles of how to be healthy, exercise, lifestyle, and behavior modification in a good way? Why not give zero interest loans to small businesses that qualify to hire people in their local communities to keep the jobs and the money circulating in that community? Simple things. Everything we're doing is just opposite what we say. And there's almost no awareness of it. Next up, statin drugs are unlikely to prevent blood clots. This is from Science Daily. So this is mainstream medicine doing a mea culpa. From PLOS One, quote, despite previous studies suggesting the contrary, statins, cholesterol-lowering drugs, may not prevent blood clots in adults, according to a large analysis by international researchers published this week in PLOS One. And what they found was, quote, in the combined analysis of over 100,000 participants in 1,000 events, the authors found that the venous thrombosis occurred in 0.9% of people taking statins compared to 1% of people not taking statins, which suggests that statins have no effect. So that means that there's no difference. Yeah, but statins have very serious side effects. You bet they do. And it's unfortunate that people are not paying attention, because there's once again a situation where medicine has sold us on why we need it to take their drugs, and here's a case where clearly we don't. From Vic Shane, PhD, from Green Med Info, sound science and common sense on the side of the organics. I'll quote this. Above all else, the United States is the marketing capital of the world. Our society is built around products and services and all the ways they are advertised to us in a way designed to outpace the competition. While it may be unethical to do so, marketing fosters its share of lying, truth-twisting, and censorship by omission. The food industry is a model food chain. The big guys try to swallow the small guys, which is why organic foods are slandered by food giants and big agra. Over the years, I've read several so-called studies that would have us believe that organic foods are no different than non-organic foods. While these may be confusing for many, those who have been eating organically for many years remain unmoved. The scientific evidence of the dangers of pesticides and other chemicals used in growing and processing non-organic foods is too great to ignore. One simple question cuts to the heart of the matter. Ultimately, to cut through the confusion, we can ask this one question to appeal to reason over the organic food issue. In what instance would it ever be advantageous and beneficial to ingest toxic, poisonous pesticides? The question is easy for health-minded people to answer, but impossible for conventional food producers to answer honestly. Clearly, it would never be a good idea to eat pesticides for any reason. Conventional foods, those grown using pesticides and other poisonous chemicals, and those grown in oft nutritionally depleted soil, contain a wide variety of chemicals that are poisonous to humans and plants and animal organisms. This main fact is often overlooked in the so-called studies comparing organics with non-organics. Instead, such studies focus on nutrient content. Non-organic food growers use chemical sprays that are neurotoxic. They damage the nerves, endocrine disrupting, interfere with hormone systems, and carcinogenic, causing cancer, and disease-causing in various other ways. Not only are pesticides used on non-organic crops, but also employed are herbicides and fungicides. It would be impossible to report all the ill effects of pesticides, but it bears mentioning that at least one example, merely to give you, the listener, an idea of the types of poisons people are consuming and that the commercial food industry claim are harmless, even beneficial to you. The National Institutes of Health report, quote, endocrine-disrupting chemicals are compounds that are able to alter the normal functioning of the endocrine system of both wildlife and humans. A huge number of chemicals have been identified as endocrine disruptors, among them several pesticides. An increased number of epidemiological studies tend to link environmental exposure to pesticides and hormone-dependent cancer risks. High levels of polychlorinated biphenyls, DDE, and DDT have been found in fat samples from women with breast cancer. The risk of breast cancer is said to be 400% greater in women with increased blood levels of DDE. One of the latest epidemiological studies performed in Spain shows that among 2,000 cases of breast cancer reported in the female population, 81% were observed in areas with high pesticide contamination. Moreover, it is also suggested that women with hormone-responsive breast cancer have a higher DDE body burden than women with benign breast disease. So There are hundreds of scientific references to the deleterious effects of pesticides, yet all are ignored in Big Agra's argument that crops sprayed with them are equal in health value to those that are not. What's in your family's refrigerator? University of Florida researchers report U.S. pesticide amount used in 2007 exceeds 600 million pounds. The largest portion of U.S. agricultural pesticides used each year was herbicides and fumigants and insecticides and miticides and fungicides and pesticides. The annual application of synthetic pesticides to food crops is enormous. So we use 5.1 billion pounds of pesticides every year in the United States. Just read the label of any bottle or can of pesticides, and you'll see it warns you. And while it's no secret the big bug sprays are bad for our health, we have to consider the political power and motives of food giants who are able to bypass all logic, all reason, and no caring for the protection of the public health. But they're there to market their products despite the realities of health risks. There are many examples of politics trumpeting public health, including the introduction of aspartame into the market, despite scientific proof that aspartame was a known neurotoxin and a carcinogen prior to the green light given to the product by the FDA. Now we're seeing the same situation with genetically engineered food, already known to pose health risks, with Monsanto still forging ahead with its plan to bring these frankenfoods to your dinner plate. Despite many scientific findings, these foods pose a health threat. The only threat that organic food poses is economic, and it's Big Agra in the commercial food industry that feels threatened. Organic food is a thorn in Monsanto's side. So what better way for the corporation than brush off their well-worn mantle and slander and decree deceit against organic? So that's the latest on that. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Oh, she didn't bat an eye as I packed my bags to leave. I thought she would start to cry. Sit around my room and weep. But you're the girl. She fooled me this time. She acted like I was the last thing on her mind. I would like to start all over again. Baby, can I change my mind? I just want to change.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now for an insight into the political human condition that rarely gets any discussion. And that is liberalism. How many times have I heard those on the left called progressives? And when I listen to some of the radio shows, the talk radio shows on non-commercial radio, I don't hear progressive. I hear liberal. There is a substantial difference. Liberalism itself is a synthetic creation of the power structure, the humanitarian facade behind which the dirty work of policing and the uninterrupted but idealistic spasm in the body politic. Journalist Eric Norden's perceptive critique, The Tender Tyranny of American Liberalism, appeared in the early years of the Vietnam era, accurately identifying how a predominantly liberal worldview projected by the ruling technocracy and its intellectual adherents acted to subordinate genuinely left progressive ideas and social movements at home while ensuring the furtherance of the U.S. imperial designs abroad. Today, Norden's insights, I believe, are worthy of reconsideration in light of how the left remains largely devoid of its own voice or vision, and more than ever, liberalism provides ideological cover for aggressive Anglo-American militarism, the prerogatives of transnational corporations, and an ever-expanding police state, what I have defined as the corporate Democrats, and hence the corporate liberals. Since the 1800s, liberalism and its utilitarian philosophical bearings have been a central intellectual and popular means by which gunboat and what is called free trade diplomacies alike are justified to the public at large. It is also a foremost rationale through which aggressive social control is exerted on the population at home, more recently by political leaders who symbolize and embody real social struggles in American history and thereby may exercise a more valid claim to feeling their constituents' pain. The modern-day liberal handily anticipates and deflects criticisms of their policies through a trumpeted alarm for a variety of social and political issues, student performance, public health, environmental degradation, and the alleged atrocities of foreign enemies, waving about an array of solutions from educational incentives, that's a code word for charter schools, and carbon credits, well, that's a complete fraud, to humanitarian military actions. Well, that's an oxymoron. That's the Janet Reno concept. In order to save the children, we first have to kill them. Norden argues how the era of American liberalism that began with Franklin Roosevelt's election established a combined cult of personality and Keynesian welfare state that has diminished the possibilities of a more radical and participatory politic. A few short years following the establishment of Students for a Democratic Society, many in the left continued to be hoodwinked and sidetracked by an oppressive militarized state effusing liberal bromides. For example, the Great Society's ambitious mantra obscured the reality that American orchestrated genocide in Vietnam was a liberal genocide. That's according to Students for Democratic Society President Carl Oglesby. The menacing coalition of industrial military power and the brutality of the Blitzkrieg we are seeing in Vietnam, he said, the ominous signs around us that hearsay may no longer be permitted are creatures, all of them, of a government that since 1932 has considered itself to be fundamentally liberal, end quote. In light of this, a miracle of social engineering and propaganda is manifest in a population that readily identifies despotism with Hitler's Nazism and Mussolini's fascism, while the exploits of authoritarian social controllers carried out under the cloak of liberalism remains almost entirely unexamined. Quote, think of the men who now engineer Vietnam. Oglesby writes, quote, those who study the maps, give the commands, push the buttons, and tally the dead, the National Security Advisor George McMundy, the Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, yes, Ambassador to South Vietnam Henry Cabot Lodge, Ambassador to the United Nations Arthur Goldberg, the President himself John F. Kennedy, they are not moral monsters. They are all honorable men. They are all liberals. End quote. Now think about that. Just take a moment. Are you fully aware that our entire expedition into Vietnam was completely thrust through by the liberal elite establishment at the time? Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, Susan Rice, Samantha Powers, John Brennan are the ideological heirs of America's Holocaust in Indochina. Their warm and caring humanitarian personalities allows the monstrous U.S.-NATO war machine to proceed without question or incident. They plan the drone kill list and oversee the accelerated tours of duty of U.S. service persons. Their associates decide which branches of al-Qaeda mercenaries will be armed and dispatched into civilian areas to maim and kill and destroy. The wars and dislocation in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria are now undeniably liberal wars carried out by our moral liberal leaders. Closer to home, Ben Bernanke and Timothy Geithner, strong advocates and practitioners of Keynesian fiscal alchemy. It's all a fraud. I've detailed it constantly on this program. At once monetize the war debt while disenfranchising the working class and retirees and the poor by creating billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, most of which are then forked over to corrupt bankers and hedge fund managers who proceed to sit on the money or further inflate the market through speculation. Bernanke and Geithner and their technocratic peers at the Fed and Treasury are cultured and thoughtful liberals, professing heartfelt concern for our lost jobs. They want us to see a social uplift. Until recently, Cass Sunstein was Obama's information czar. The Lowell scholar professed an appreciation for rational public discourse and exchange. Well, that's good, isn't it? Yet in his academic writings, he exhibited unbridled disdain for unconventional speculation and critique of government activities and policies. To the extent of advocating COINTELPRO spying style cognitive infiltration, he called it, of groups discussing and circulating such ideas. So, Sunstein's liberal credentials are indisputable. He's at the top of the food chain. And yet, he's acting like J. Edgar Hoover out of drag. Over the past several decades, America's chief warmongers and advocates of technocratic social control exude the aura of kind and caring masters who have been unwilling to go into war unless forced to, and of course only because of humanitarian concerns. They have a responsibility to protect foreign peoples from the alleged oppression of their leaders, many of which are modern, pro-Western, and U.S. allies. The fruits of the violent Arab Spring color revolution are case in point. Today, the world is told by the Nobel Peace Prize president how a new era of humanitarian interventionism has arrived through the establishment of the Susan Brown and Samantha Powers-inspired Atrocities Prevention Board. According to the president, the study Directive 10 of August 4th, 2011, laying the groundwork for this to happen. So, yes, there will be ultra-violence in U.S.-backed NATO and guerrilla warfare and air bombardments of Libya. But it's not because we want to hurt anybody. We're liberals. Obama identifies the prevention of mass atrocities and genocide, quote, as a core national security interest and a core moral responsibility of the United States, end quote. Almost as if on cue, the administration's liberal backers applaud such maneuvers. The Nation magazine and other programs, much like Vietnam, these military ventures are carried out under the guise of liberalism, and we roundly condemn by liberals as much of anything if this had happened under a professed conservative administration. In reality, had Obama been in office and embarked on the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq while uttering the appropriate humanitarian-sounding statements, he would have succeeded with nary a peep from most, if not all, of the left liberal intelligentsia. In the 1950s and 60s, liberalism constituted the ideological armature of the Cold War consensus, which provided for the massive Keynesian military buildup and the eventual recolonization of the Third World under brutal International Monetary Fund and World Bank auspices. Oh, did you forget they were connected? Did you forget where they get their money? From us. At the same time, however, social programs such as Medicare and the expansion of public higher education were in their infancy, thus providing concrete appeasement for the U.S. population. Throw them a bone. Norden points to the Great Society as liberalism's giant con designed to assure the American public that whatever horrors we perpetrate abroad, our hearts are still in the right places. Whatever injustice persists at home, things are going to get better. In the absence of such compensation, the American public today is afforded a simulacra of 1960s social struggle while similar imperial wars are waged abroad and barely a finger is lifted as America's infrastructure crumbles. Industrial jobs are continually outsourced, and the earth sustains what are likely her greatest environmental catastrophes in the Gulf of Mexico, the spill, and the dire Fukushima nuclear meltdowns. In fact, the American liberal establishment overlooks such trifling events, content in the notion that it has overcome racism with an African American in the highest office, even as he busies himself dutifully enacting the policies of zombie banks, insurance and pharmaceutical conglomerates, and the military-industrial surveillance complex. Despite their protestations of moderation, liberals are the most ruthless of ideological fanatics. If challenged on this point, the average liberal will ooze the milk of human kindness from every pore, his eyes melting over to the constituency of hot butterscotch sauce. Is he not against extremism in every shape and form? But those who really cross liberalism are pursued with cold, implacable fury, up to and even beyond the grave. And while American liberalism exudes understanding and open-mindedness as its principal outward expressions, it is not satiated until it has achieved consensus on its terms and subsumed all intellectual challengers. What is more, it sees in the notion that one or more political outlooks exist apart from what its disciples have endorsed and mandated. Thus, efforts are methodically employed to discipline public discourse and thought along lines favorable to the liberal project of political correctness. Remember when Howard Dean got angry? Ooh, liberals don't get angry. They're running public office. Can't do that. You're out. Much like the 1960s, as Norden suggests, one method of accomplishing this is through liberals' relativism. In this view, there are no absolute truth, no absolute good, no absolute evil, permitting only a monochromatic wasteland of differing shades of gray. Such an outlook, quote, leads to despair and pessimism and ultimately to a nihilistic manipulation of any and all values. It also, of course, provides a ready handle with which to dismiss all extremism and to proclaim, as liberal guru Daniel Bell does so triumphantly, the end of ideology. In the 1960s, the liberals' wholesale destruction of Indochina and its people to forestall the alleged domino effect, which was a fraud, was the most visible and cold-blooded of their ventures. Yet liberalism's efforts to chasten and guide public discussion regarding the domestic activities of the deep state for which it stands are oft forgotten. The assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Malcolm X, and later Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, are especially poignant examples of liberalism's overwhelming pretense that has only intensified in recent years. When Malcolm X persistently violated liberal discursive protocols by straying from the center through his intellectually incisive observations on American race relations, he was routinely castigated in liberal venues for his transgressions. Shortly before his death, he told his biographer, "Watch how they will accuse me of hate." Well, true to form, the traditional liberal venues sprang to life after his corpse was laid to rest. The New York Times, quote, "Malcolm X's life was strangely and pitifully wasted," declared the New York Times the day after he died. Was it? Wasn't for those of us who got a message from him. But this was because he did not seek to fit into a society or the world he saw through those horn-rimmed glasses of his was distorted and dark. But he made it darker still with his exaltation of fanaticism, we were told. Did he? Don't think so. The hugely egotistical Lyndon Johnson, second only to FDR in his liberal credentials, simultaneously waged the Vietnam War and the so-called War on Poverty, where Martin Luther King Jr. called Johnson out for his extravagant hypocrisy in his notable April 4, 1967 Beyond Vietnam address at Riverside Church. Johnson fumed with indignation, and subsequent evidence indicates high federal government involvement in King's execution exactly 1 year later. Along similar lines today, public figures critiquing liberalism's foremost projects, the Affordable Care Act, global warming or climate change, President Obama's biography, or Osama bin Laden's uncertain departure are correspondingly singled out for blistering and slanderous condemnation complete with tailor-made epithets. Given these excesses in political guile, is it any surprise that one of the most powerful contemporary bastions of liberalism and shameless appropriators of civil rights struggle, the Southern Poverty Law Center, classifies an activist organization called We Are Change as a hate group simply because its members have routinely questioned U.S. government's often implausible explanations for the September 11, 2001 terror attacks? true to its liberal bona fides. If Malcolm X were alive now, he would no doubt be labeled as an extremist, a hater, a racist, perhaps even a conspiracy racist. Little has changed since 1965. The rabble capable of articulating the world as they see it are usually clumsy at learning how to identify and navigate certain avenues of tasteful dissent. Speaking for the liberal intelligentsia in 1965, at the time when there was considerable skepticism over the establishment's account of how JFK was assassinated, historian Richard Hofstadter warned of the dangers awaiting intellectuals who might drift from the treacherous waters of the paranoid style in an ideological move characteristic of an openly totalitarian society and taken to a whole new level by the liberal thought police at the organization. Hofstadter was more than subtle, suggesting how journalists and academics alike jeopardized their standing in their community by questioning anything about the JFK assassination. And once the evidence surrounding JFK's death pointed to, quote, a well-organized conspiracy within the agencies of the federal government, end quote, the liberals looked the other way. JFK could be mourned, but not avenged. Too many apple carts could have been upset in the process. In the end, liberals fell in lockstep, moving forward while simultaneously betraying the principles they claimed to uphold and once and for all denying their own historical agency. Since 2001, some of the most vocal detractors of the 9/11 truth movement have not been conservatives, but rather left liberal intellectuals, the foremost among them, Noam Chomsky. Chomsky's pronouncements and leadership in this regard are exemplary, yet also consistent with his liberal technocratic forebears, setting the tone for the collective silence of left academicians and the so-called progressive alternative media. This September 11th attack, quote, he says, was surely an enormous shock and surprise in the intelligence services of the West. No, it wasn't. Do your homework, Chomsky. Chomsky's remarks deserve attention given his notoriety among the left. And so it is. In conclusion, alongside liberalism's disciplining its own adherents from improper thought and theory, and thereby distracting the public from further interrogating the deep state's roles in political assassinations or September 11th attack or false flags attacks, it is better than to be complicit and not to suggest anything more. Americans and the citizens of nations elsewhere have continually been asked by much of the Anglo-American intellectual and political class to direct their frustrations to the right. Yet I see it as also coming from the left. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to hear your thoughts in our talkback segment. Please give us a call at 888-874-4888. After all, what am I saying? I'm saying that stop blaming the conservative or the right for all things wrong in the world. Take an honest look at what has wrapped itself in the cloak of liberalism from the Vietnam War and the Kennedys and the people around them and the liberal intelligentsia. And look at where we are today. Look at who is bailing out the banks. Who is authorizing the Fed to do this? Who is not changing a single way that the homeowners are being evicted? It's our liberal Congress working hand in hand with the conservatives. To our guests in a moment, your calls, however, I want to take just one moment as we do one day a week, so no other program on the Progressive Radio Network has to ever raise funds. By the way, we're the only 24/7 non-commercial network, the fastest growing in the world, by the way. Yesterday alone, we had 45,000 people come over to read our articles, 5,400 brand new listeners just yesterday. That's 1,500,000 new ones a year. And these are younger, college-educated, listening from their homes. Anyhow, I take only 3 minutes once a week and offer a product that I've created that goes, all of the proceeds go to the station, And this way we don't have to have anyone raise funds. Today, that product that I've created is called Muscle. It's a protein, a vegan rice protein, 500 grams. And it also has the branched-chain amino acid. It has a delicious cherry vanilla flavor. And it's completely vegan, quality protein. And here's the deal today. You would normally pay $49.95, but you're going to get this at $24.95. Plus, I'm also giving you a $40 video on hair and skin, a natural approach, a DVD, free. So that's, what is that? That's almost $90. So you're making a big saving. For $24.95, you're getting a humongous discount, somewhere, I think, around $60 or $70 savings. Here's the number you're going to call. You're going to call this number and get our special. It is 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And ask for your Muscle. It's a wonderful, delicious, very nutritious protein powder with the branched amino acids. You're going to get it for half price, and you're getting a free DVD to boot. All right? That's a great deal. So call now, 877-627-5065. Alex from New Jersey, to you and then to our guest. Alex, your turn.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
I want to ask a question. You talk about the collapse of the dollar, and for us here in the U.S., how would that affect us, meaning that, you know, let's say a loaf of bread will cost $8 or $10 a loaf of bread, and gas might be $15, $25. Exactly what does that mean if we have $10,000 in the bank and our mortgages and all that?
Okay, what it means is this. Well, gas is not going to go that high unless there is a war with Iran, and there is almost a certainty that's going to happen because the neocons who got us into the 2003 war want to get us in this one, and they have their own agendas. Unfortunately, it does not align itself with anything that's beneficial to us, nor the people of the Middle East. Then you'll see gas go up because the oil will be substantially sabotaged getting out of the Straits of Hormuz. So then it could go to $15 a gallon. What it means now is that because the Fed is printing so much money, and the Fed is buying up mortgages, toxic mortgages. So all the people who had liar loans and all the people who had bad mortgages that the banks have on their balance sheets, the Fed is buying that up now. They're buying them up to destroy those mortgages, giving the banks 100 cents on the dollar. So every single mistake that every one of these banks made, they've been made whole. The trouble is the American consumer is not, and nor will they be. It also means when you have that much currency being printed and you have a country with unfunded, underfunded, and total debt of over $116 trillion. Remember, they're not looking at corporate debt. They're not looking at household debt, credit card debt, student loan debt. They're only at the state debt, unfunded, underfunded pensions within the states. They're not looking at the amount of money, $6.5 trillion we've already borrowed from other countries that we'll never pay back, and all of our underfunded entitlements. You start adding that up, and you're 10 times almost our gross domestic product to debt, meaning we have more debt than we have gross domestic product. We're right up there with Ireland. So they keep printing and printing and printing money. And then China begins to trade with Russia and use their currency, the Chinese currency, yuan, rather than our dollar. And then everyone else starts using their currencies rather than our dollar. Then the reserve currency failure means that the value of the dollar will substantially decline. People won't be rushing into dollars. They'll be rushing to get rid of dollars for other currencies like the Swiss franc. Excuse me, or the French, Swiss currency. So let's say you have money in the bank, it'll be worth less. What you go to buy will cost more because you'll end up with some hyperinflation. What you buy will be worth less. So that's what it means. Thanks for your call. Let's say hello to Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter Bregan, as I mentioned earlier in the program, is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist and a former consultant for the National Institutes of Mental Health. He is also one of the harshest critics of current conventional psychotherapeutic approaches in treating mental disorders in both adults and children. Along with his wife, he is the founder of the Center for the Study of Empathetic Therapy, a nonprofit organization providing scientific-based information on dangers and adverse effects of psychiatric drugs. His most recent book is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a Guide for Prescribers, Therapists, Patients, and Families, which gives a very comprehensive layperson review of the strategies and stages and symptoms of drug withdrawal. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, it's great to be on your show, Gary. Very good.
Explain to us why, in your opinion, the Surgeon General, Regina Benjamin, says that, yes, we have 38,000 suicides that have been reported on in military personnel and veterans, and yet not a word about the drugs they've been taking.
Yeah, well, it's inexcusable, Gary. As you know, I testified before the House of Representatives Committee on Veterans Affairs in 2010, pointing out that the rising suicide rates are being caused in good part, in a significant part, by psychiatric drugs. So it's not like this is a mystery to the federal government. It's also been in some of the military newspapers. And, of course, I've been talking about it on Huffington Post and other places in my blog. So there's no mystery at all. The government is simply refusing to look at what's going on when it's so hand in glove with the pharmaceutical industry. You know, the pharmaceutical industry, as you know, is always looking for new markets. And they found this great top-down market in the military. And they've got a huge chunk of our soldiers, even on active duty, taking psychiatric drugs, being sent off 180 days worth of psychiatric drugs, including stimulants, benzos, even antipsychotic drugs. So it's a disastrous situation. And then when they come back, if they show any signs of emotional problems, they are likely to be put on 4 or 5 drugs, and we're getting sudden death from these huge mixtures of psychiatric drugs. So there's no excuse at all for anybody in the federal government not to know we're in an epidemic, disastrous situation with our soldiers and drugs. It mimics what's going on in the country, of course. You know, we've got last year's estimate was 20% of Americans taking psychiatric drugs, and I think that that's an underestimate. And if you think about the fact that many of them will take them soon or have had them in the past, probably half of our population now has been drugged at one time or another. That's a major motivation for why I wrote Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. The first half of the book, Gary, talks about how dangerous the drugs are if you're taking them for months or years. You know, I've talked a lot in the past about the acute dangers, suicide, violence, mania, and so on for many of these drugs. But longer term, months or years, we're getting more evidence of brain damage, outright brain damage from psychiatric drugs, and what I describe in the book is chronic brain impairment, with loss of some of the mental faculties, difficulty doing multitasking, increased irritability, and a lack of interest in other people and in life. And overall, what happens to patients on psychiatric drugs for a long period of time is that quite often, not always, but quite often, they're going to just have a decline in the quality of life. But it's also it's just very hazardous to come off drugs after you've been on them for years. So I've developed this book that patients can use and doctors can use and the therapist can use and the family can use to do a team effort at getting off psychiatric drugs, first in understanding their dangers and then in helping get off them. And I've written in a way that the patient could actually bring it to the doctor or the therapist, because I want to see therapists taking these issues more seriously now and actually develop a team effort of people really getting some knowledge about how to come off the drugs.
Well, I appreciate what you've done in this matter, and of course, I've read all of your books, really appreciate them, and for anyone trying to get off a drug, Paxil, Prozac, Effexor, any of these, please read Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, A Guide for Prescribers, Therapists, Patients, and Families by Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter, thank you very much for being on. And Peter Bregan can be heard every week on the Progressive Radio Network, a very popular program he does. All the best to you, Peter.
Thanks so much, Gary, for your support.
Let's go over and say hello to Luann Panessi, who's standing by to round out the program. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Just an aside, so people know, many people know that I had very bad skin at one point. I had acne and pock marks, and my hair was very dry and brittle when I first started on your protocol. And that hair and skin DVD, and as far as I'm concerned, made all the difference. I got so much information and so many insights from that piece. It was amazing, and people will can see me today and see the big difference in my skin and my hair. Anyway, I have a woman here who said her mother passed away just recently at 95 years old, and she said that she feels that the cause was the flu shot, because right after it she got sick and was hospitalized, and she got infections in the hospital. But she wanted you to know that she would be here today power walking. 31 years ago she was told that she should go to hospice because she had emphysema and she was a chronic drinker. And when she was first diagnosed, she said, my sister flew up from Florida, and she's an avid listener and supporter of you and your shows, and talk with her and convince her to get on your protocol. Of course, 2 weeks later, they found out that all the supplements they gave her were sitting in a box somewhere. So they ended up getting creative and made her a bunch of chocolate shakes, which was her favorite flavor, throwing in all of the supplements. And she ended up taking her smoothie every day. And she finally said yes to getting IV chelation and intravenous vitamin C. And over time, she became healthier and healthier, and she became free of her emphysema, and her liver improved, and she was a fully functional person. And she never used the Internet, so obviously she never heard your shows on vaccines. And she says, we miss her, and she says, she would have reminded you of Tallulah Bankhead, a real Southern belle with some attitude. But she wanted to thank you for all of your information that helped her mom, you know, live to that age. We get a lot of nice stories like this that come to me on the Internet.
I'm glad to hear that. I've heard from Celeste Holmes, who died at 95, and several others this year who were in their late 90s who passed. There's one who's still going strong, Louise Rainier, who won 2 Academy Awards back in the 1930s. She's 103, living in London. And,
wow.
I see her her nephew on the streets on the Upper West Side. He's a writer and tells me how she's doing. So that's good. It's always nice to see people are doing well.
My mom plays bridge, and in her bridge group, there's a 104-year-old woman who coaches everyone in how to play bridge. Alert as can be. Walking around, I don't think we realize how many of our elderly are out there and functional and helping people.
What my goal is to get to a place where we can have an entire generation understand cause and effect, so that we don't get to 90, 100, and people are surprised. It becomes the new norm because of all the choices we've made. And when we realize we can do that, it's just the consistency of it. And more often than not around the world, you'll see as a percentage of the population, those who are living to 100 in good health are generally the people in Okinawa, people in Japan, and on the island Crete, in the country of Georgia, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. And because they've made healthier choices for longer periods of time. As the great Linus Pauling, who won 2 Nobel Prize, no one else has done that in the United States, they were unshared, he said to me about 7 months before he died, he said, you know, Gary, when I die, I'm sure what's going to happen is the critics will say, see, the vitamin C didn't do him any good. Instead of the truth was, he said, had he began to have a healthier life earlier and start making all the best choices in his 20s or 30s, he would have been dynamically healthy at 94. But to have made it to 94 in outstanding health was the key. And he did make it in outstanding health. But from his smoking and drinking, his bad diet for 60 years, mind you, you abuse your body for 60 years, you have a lot of accumulated DNA defects. And he wasn't one to do a holistic program. You know, it was mainly vitamin C. But had he done everything, then he would be alive today. My goal is sometime in the next 12 months to take a group of individuals to a location and have them spend 1 year, one full year, doing everything that we now know can help reverse the aging process, and to film it, to document it, to do all the blood workups and medical exams to show what is possible, and then present that. I've already have an article out for presentation to a World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine, and I'm on the arthritis study that was done earlier this year, and I'm pretty sure that this would get everyone's attention. So it's not, I'm not ready yet, but maybe in maximum 6 months now, probably March or so, I'll put the word out. Thanks for your call.
Great.
Remember, Sunday night, 8 p.m., live on the Progressive Radio Network Talkback, a whole hour on health and nutrition, no guest, just phone calls and lots of positive information. Have a wonderful day, everyone. I look forward to sharing more on our next visit.